Turner stared at Conroy, then nodded. Turning, he lifted the edge of the next dust cover. Cases, plastic and styrofoam, stacked neatly on the cold metal of the table. He touched a blue plastic rectangle stamped with a silver monogram. S and W. Your agent, Conroy said, as Turner snapped the case open. The pistol lay there in its molded bed of pale blue foam. A massive revolver, with an ugly housing that bulged beneath the squat barrel. S&W Tactical 408 with a xenon projector, Conroy said. What he said you'd want. Turner took the gun in his hand and thumbed the battery test stud for the projector. A red LED in the walnut grip pulsed twice. He swung the cylinder out. Ammunition? On the table. Hand loads, explosive tips. Turner found a transparent cube of amber plastic, opened it with his left hand, and extracted a cartridge. Why did they pick me for this, Conroy? He examined the cartridge, then inserted it carefully into one of the cylinder's six chambers.
I don't know, Conroy said. Felt like they had you slotted from go, whenever they heard from Mitchell.
Turner spun the cylinder rapidly and snapped it back into the frame. I said, why did they pick me for this, Conroy? He raised the pistol with both hands and extended his arms, pointing it directly at Conroy's face.
Gun like this, sometimes you can see right down the bore. If the light's right. See if there's a bullet there.
Conroy shook his head very slightly. Or maybe you can see it in one of the other chambers. No. Conroy said very softly. No way.
Maybe the shrink screwed up, Conroy. How about that?
No. Conroy said, his face blank. They didn't, and you won't. Turner pulled the trigger. The hammer clicked on an empty chamber. Conroy blinked once, opened his mouth, closed it, watched as Turner lowered the Smith & Wesson. A single bead of sweat rolled down from Conroy's hairline and lost itself in an eyebrow.
Well?
Turner asked, the gun at his side. Conroy shrugged. Don't do that shit, he said.
They want me that bad?
Conroy nodded. It's your show, Turner.
Where's Mitchell?
He opened the cylinder again and began to load the five remaining chambers.
Arizona? About 50 kilos from the Sonora line, in a Mesa Top Research Arcology. Moss Biolabs, North America. They own everything around there, right down to the border, and the mesa's smack in the middle of the footprints of four recon satellites. Mucho tight.
And how are we supposed to get in?
We aren't. Mitchell's coming out on his own. We wait for him, pick him up, get his ass to Hosaka intact.
Conroy hooked a forefinger behind the open collar of his black shirt and drew out a length of black nylon cord, then a small black nylon envelope with a Velcro fastener. He opened it carefully and extracted an object, which he offered to Turner on his open palm. Here. This is what he sent. Turner put the gun down on the nearest table and took the thing from Conroy. It was like a swollen gray Microsoft. One end, routine neurojack. The other, a strange, rounded formation, unlike anything he'd seen.
What is it?
It's Biosoft. Jaylene jacked it and said she thought it was output from an AI. It's sort of a dossier on Mitchell, with a message to Hosaka tacked on the end. You better jack it yourself. You want to get the picture fast.
Turner glanced up from the gray thing.
How to grab Jaylene?
She said you better be lying down when you do it. She didn't seem to like it much. Machine dreams hold a special vertigo. Turner lay down on a virgin slab of green temper foam in the makeshift dorm and jacked Mitchell's dossier. It came on slow. He had time to close his eyes. 10 seconds later, his eyes were open. He clutched the green foam and fought his nausea. Again, he closed his eyes. It came on. Again. Gradually. A flickering, non-linear flood of fact and sensory data. A kind of narrative conveyed in surreal jump cuts and juxtapositions. It was vaguely like riding a roller coaster that phased in and out of existence at random. Impossibly rapid intervals, changing altitude, attack and direction with each pulse of nothingness, except that the shifts had nothing to do with any physical orientation, but rather with lightning alternations in paradigm and symbol system. The data had never been intended for human input. Eyes open, he pulled the thing from his socket and held it, his palms slick with sweat. It was like waking from a nightmare. Not a screamer, where impacted fears took on simple, terrible shapes. But the sort of dream infinitely more disturbing, where everything is perfectly and horribly normal, and where everything is utterly wrong. The intimacy of the thing was hideous. He fought down waves of raw transference, bringing all his will to bear on crushing a feeling that was akin to love. The obsessive tenderness a watcher comes to feel for the subject of prolonged surveillance. Days or hours later, he knew the most minute details of Mitchell's academic record might bob to the surface of his mind. Or the name of a mistress. The scent of her heavy red hair in the sunlight through. He sat up quickly, the plastic soles of his shoes smacking the rusted deck. He still wore the parka, and the Smith & Wesson, in a side pocket, swung painfully against his hip. It would pass. Mitchell's psychic odor would fade, as surely as the Spanish grammar and the lexicon evaporated after each use. What he had experienced was a mass security dossier compiled by a sentient computer. Nothing more. He replaced the Biosoft in Conroy's little black wallet, smoothed the Velcro seal with his thumb, and put the cord around his neck. He became aware of the sound of waves lapping the flanks of the rig. "Hey, boss," someone said from beyond the brown military blanket that screened the entrance to the dorm area. "Conroy says it's time for you to inspect the troops. Then you and him depart for other parts." Oki's bearded face slid from behind the blanket. "Otherwise, I wouldn't wake you up, right?"
"I wasn't sleeping," Turner said, and stood, fingers reflexively kneading the skin around the implanted socket.
"Too bad," Oki said. "I got derms will put you under all the way. 1 hour on the button, then kicking some kind of righteous upper, get you up and on the case, no lie."
Turner shook his head. "Take me to Conroy." Chapter 5. The Job. Marley checked into a small hotel with green plants and heavy brass pots. The corridors tiled like worn marble chessboards. The elevator was a scrolled gilt cage with rosewood panels, smelling of lemon oil and small cigars. Her room was on the fifth floor. A single tall window overlooked the avenue. The kind of window you could actually open. When the smiling bellman had gone, she collapsed into an armchair, whose plush fabric contrasted comfortably with the muted Belgian carpet.
She undid the zips on her old Paris boots for the last time, kicked them off, and stared at the dozen glossy carrier bags the bellman had arranged on the bed. Tomorrow, she thought, she'd buy luggage. And a toothbrush.
I'm in shock.
She said to the bags on the bed,
I must take care. Nothing seems real now.
She looked down and saw that her hose were both out at the toe. She shook her head. Her new purse lay on the white marble table beside the bed. It was black, cut from cowhide tanned thick and soft as Flemish butter. It had cost more than she would have owed Andrea for her share of a month's rent, but that was also true of a single night stay in this hotel. The purse contained her passport and the credit chip she'd been issued in the Galerie du Perret, drawn on an account held in her name by an Orbital branch of the Nederlands Algemeen Bank. She went into the bathroom and worked the smooth brass levers of the big white tub. Hot, aerated water hissed out through a Japanese filtration device. The hotel provided packets of bath salts, tubes of creams, and scented oils. She emptied a tube of oil into the filling tub and began to remove her clothes, feeling a pang of loss when she tossed the Sally Stanley behind her. Until an hour before, the year-old jacket had been her favorite garment and perhaps the single most expensive thing she'd ever owned. Now it was something for the cleaners to take away. Perhaps it would find its way to one of the city's flea markets, the sort of place where she'd hunted bargains as an art school girl. The mirrors misted and ran as the room filled with scented steam, blurring the reflection of her nakedness. Was it really this easy? Had Virek's slim gold credit chip checked her out of her misery and into this hotel, where the towels were white and thick and scratchy? She was aware of a certain spiritual vertigo, as though she trembled at the edge of some precipice. She wondered how powerful money could actually be if one had enough of it, really enough. She supposed that only the Viriks of the world could really know. And very likely, they were functionally incapable of knowing. Asking Virek would be like interrogating a fish in order to learn more about water.
Yes, my dear, it's wet. Yes, my child, it's certainly warm, scented, scratchy-toweled.
She stepped into the tub and lay down. Tomorrow she would have her hair cut in Paris. Andrea's phone rang 16 times before Marley remembered the special program. It would still be in place, and this expensive little Brussels hotel would not be listed. She leaned out to replace the handset on the marble-topped table, and it chimed once, softly.
A courier has delivered a parcel from the Galerie du Perret?
When the bellman, a younger man this time, dark and possibly Spanish, had gone, she took the package to the window and turned it over in her hands. It was wrapped in a single sheet of handmade paper, dark gray, folded and tucked in that mysterious Japanese way that required neither glue nor string. But she knew that once she'd opened it, she'd never get it folded again. The name and address of the Galerie were embossed in one corner, and her name and the name of her hotel were handwritten across the center in perfect italic script. She unfolded the paper and found herself holding a new brown holo projector and a flat envelope of clear plastic. The envelope contained 7 numbered tabs of holofiche. Beyond the miniature iron balcony, the sun was going down, painting the old town gold. She heard car horns and the cries of children. She closed the window and crossed to a writing desk. The brown was a smooth black rectangle powered by solar cells. She checked the charge, then took the first holofiche from the envelope and slotted it. The box she'd seen in Virek's simulation of the Gwell Park blossomed above the brown, glowing with the crystal resolution of the finest museum-grade holograms. Bone and circuit gold, dead lace, and a dull white marble rolled from clay. Marley shook her head. How could anyone have arranged these bits, this garbage, in such a way that it caught at the heart, snagged in the soul like a fishhook? But then she nodded. It could be done, she knew. It had been done many years ago by a man named Cornell, who'd also made boxes. Then she glanced to the left, where the elegant gray paper lay on the desktop. She'd chosen this hotel at random, when she'd grown tired of shopping. She'd told no one she was here, and certainly no one from the Galerie du Bourret. Chapter 6 Barrytown. He stayed out for something like 8 hours, by the clock in his mother's Hitachi. Came to staring at its dusty face, some hard thing wedged under his thigh. The Ono Sendai. He rolled over. Stale puke smell. Then he was in the shower, not sure quite how he'd gotten there, spinning the taps with his clothes still on. He clawed and dug and pulled at his face. It felt like a rubber mask. Something happened. Something bad, big, he wasn't sure what. His wet clothes gradually mounded up on the tile floor of the shower. Finally, he stepped out, went to the sink and flicked wet hair back from his eyes, peered at the face in the mirror. Bobby Newmark. No problem. No Bobby problem. Got a problem. Towel around his shoulders, dripping water, he followed the narrow hallway to his bedroom, a tiny wedge-shaped space at the very back of the condo. His hollow porn unit lit as he stepped in, half a dozen girls grinning, eyeing him with evident delight. They seemed to be standing beyond the walls of the room in hazy vistas of powder blue space, their white smiles and taut young bodies bright as neon. Two of them edged forward and began to touch themselves. "Stop it," he said. The projection unit shut itself down at his command. The dream girls vanished. The thing had originally belonged to Ling Warren's older brother. The girls' hair and clothes were dated and vaguely ridiculous. You could talk with them and get them to do things with themselves and each other. Bobby remembered being 13 and in love with Brandy, the one with the blue rubber pants. Now he valued the projections mainly for the illusion of space they could provide in the makeshift bedroom. "Something fucking happened," he said, pulling on black jeans and an almost clean shirt. He shook his head. "What? Fucking what?" "Some kind of power surge on the line? Some fluky action down at the fission authority? Maybe the base he'd tried to invade had suffered some strange breakdown or been attacked from another quarter. But he was left with the sense of having met someone, someone who..." He'd unconsciously extended his right hand, fingers spread beseechingly. "Fuck!" he said. The fingers balled into a fist. Then it came back. First, the sense of the big thing, the really big thing, reaching for him across cyberspace, and then the girl impression. Someone brown, slender, crouching somewhere in a strange bright dark full of stars and wind. But it slid away as his mind went for it. Hungry, he got into sandals and headed back toward the kitchen, rubbing at his hair with a damp towel. On his way through the living room, he noticed the on telltale of the Ono Sendai glaring at him from the carpet. Oh, shit. He stood there and sucked at his teeth. It was still jacked in. Was it possible that it was still linked with the base he'd tried to run? Could they tell he wasn't dead? He had no idea. One thing he did know, though, was that they'd have his number in good. He hadn't bothered with the cutouts and frills that would have kept them from running a backtrack. They had his address. Hunger forgotten, he spun into the bathroom and rooted through the soggy clothing until he found his credit chip. He had 210 new yen stashed in the hollow plastic handle of a multi-bit screwdriver. Screwdriver and credit chip secure in his jeans, he pulled on his oldest, heaviest pair of boots, then clawed unwashed clothing from beneath the bed. He came up with a black canvas jacket with at least a dozen pockets. One of them, a single huge pouch across the small of the back, a kind of integral rucksack. There was a Japanese gravity knife with orange handles beneath his pillow. That went into a narrow pocket on the jacket's left sleeve, near the cuff. The dream girls clicked in as he was leaving.
Bobby, Bobby, come back and play.
In his living room, he yanked the Ono Sendai's jack from the face of the Hitachi, coiling the fiber optic lead and tucking it into a pocket. He did the same with the Trode set, then slid the Ono Sendai into the jacket's pack pocket. The curtains were still drawn. He felt a surge of some new exhilaration. He was leaving. He had to leave. Already he'd forgotten the pathetic fondness that his brush with death had generated. He parted the curtains carefully, a thumb-wide gap, and peered out. It was late afternoon. In a few hours, the first lights would start blinking on in the dark bulks of the projects. Big playground swept away like a concrete sea. The projects rose beyond the opposite shore. Vast rectilinear structures, softened by a random overlay of retrofitted greenhouse balconies, catfish tanks, solar heating systems, and the ubiquitous chicken wire dishes. Two-a-day would be up there now, sleeping, in a world Bobby had never seen, the world of a mincom arcology. Two-a-day came down to do business, mostly with the hot doggers in Barrytown, and then he climbed back up. It had always looked good to Bobby up there. So much happening on the balconies at night, amid red smudges of charcoal. Little kids in their underwear swarming like monkeys, so small you could barely see them. Sometimes the wind would shift, and the smell of cooking would settle over big playground. And sometimes you'd see an ultralight glide out from some secret country of rooftops so high up there. And always the mingled beat from a million speakers. Waves of music that pulsed and faded in and out of the wind. Two-a-day never talked about his life, where he lived. Two-a-day talked biz, or, to be more social, women. What Two-a-day said about women made Bobby want to get out of Barrytown worse than ever. And Bobby knew that biz would be his only ticket out. But now he needed the dealer in a different way, because now he was entirely out of his depth. Maybe Two-a-day could tell him what was happening. There wasn't supposed to be any lethal stuff around that base. Two-a-day had picked it out for him, then rented him the software he'd need to get in, and Two-a-day was ready to fence anything he could have gotten out with. So Two-a-day had to know. Know something anyway. "I don't even have your number, man," he said to the projects, letting the curtains fall shut. Should he leave something for his mother? A note? "My ass," he said to the room behind him. "Outta here." And then he was out the door and down the hall, headed for the stairs. "Forever," he added, kicking open an exit door. Big Playground looked safe enough, except for a lone shirtless duster deep in some furious conversation with God. Bobby cut the duster a wide circle. He was shouting and jumping and karate chopping the air. The duster had dried blood on his bare feet, and the remnants of what had probably been a lobe haircut. Big Playground was neutral territory, at least in theory, and the lobes were loosely confederated with the Gothics. Bobby had fairly solid affiliations with the Gothics, but retained his indie status. Barrytown was a dicey place to be an indie. At least, he thought, as the duster's angry gibberish faded behind him. The gangs gave you some structure. If you were Gothic and the casuals chopped you out, it made sense. Maybe the ultimate reasons behind it were crazy, but there were rules. But indies got chopped out by dusters running on brainstem, by roaming predatory loonies from as far away as New York, like that penis collector character last summer, kept the goods in his pocket in a plastic bag. Bobby had been trying to chart a way out of this landscape since the day he was born, or anyway it felt that way. Now, as he walked, the cyberspace deck in the pack pocket banged against his spine, like it too was urging him to get out. "Come on, Two-A-Day," he said to the looming projects. "Get your ass down out of there and be in Leon's when I get there, okay?" Two-A-Day wasn't in Leon's. Nobody was. Unless you wanted to count Leon, who was probing the inner mysteries of a wall screen converter with a bent paperclip. "Why don't you just get a hammer and pound the fucker till it works?" Bobby asked. "Do you about as much good." Leon looked up from the converter. He was probably in his 40s, but it was hard to say. He seemed to be of no particular race, or in certain lights, to belong to some race that nobody else belonged to. Lots of hypertrophied facial bone and a mane of curly, non-reflective black hair. His basement pirate club had been a fixture in Bobby's life for the past 2 years. Leon stared dully at Bobby with his unnerving eyes, pupils of nacreous gray overlaid with a hint of translucent olive. Leon's eyes made Bobby think of oysters and nail polish, two things he didn't particularly like to think about in connection with eyes. The color was like something they'd use to upholster bar stools. "I just mean you can't fix shit like that by poking at it," Bobby added uncomfortably. Leon shook his head slowly and went back to his exploration. People paid to get into the place because Leon pirated Kino and Simstim off cable and ran a lot of stuff that Barrytowners couldn't otherwise afford to access. There was dealing in the back, and you could make donations for drinks. Mostly clean Ohio hooch, cut with some synthetic orange drink Leon scored in industrial quantities. "Say, Leon," Bobby began again, "you seen Two-A-Day in here lately?" The horrible eyes came up again and regarded Bobby for entirely too long.
"No."
"Maybe last night?"
"No."
"Night before?"
"No."
"Oh. Okay. Thanks." There was no point in giving Leon a hard time. Lots of reasons not to, actually. Bobby looked around at the wide, dim room, at the SimStim units and the unlit Kino screens. The club was a series of nearly identical rooms in the basement of a semi-residential rack zoned for singles and a sprinkling of light industry. Good soundproofing. You hardly ever heard the music, not from outside. Plenty of nights he'd popped out of Leon's with a head full of noise and pills into what seemed a magic vacuum of silence, his ears ringing all the way home across Big Playground. Now he had an hour probably before the first Gothic started to arrive. The dealers, mostly black guys from the projects, or whites from the city, or some other burb, wouldn't turn up until there was a patch of Gothics for them to work on. Nothing made a dealer look worse than just sitting there, waiting, because that would mean you weren't getting any action. And there was no way a genuinely hot dealer would be hanging out in Leon's just for the pleasure of it. It was all hot dog shit in Leon's. Weekenders with cheap decks who watched Japanese icebreaker kinos. But Two-A-Day wasn't like that, he told himself, on his way up the concrete stairs. Two-A-Day was on his way. Out of the projects, out of Barrytown, out of Leon's. On his way to the Cité. To Paris, maybe, or Chiba. The Onosendai bumped against his spine. He remembered that Two-A-Day's icebreaker cassette was still in it. He didn't want to have to explain that to anyone. He passed a news kiosk. A yellow fax of the New York edition of the Asahi Shimbun was reeling past a plastic window in the mirrored siding. Some government going down in Africa. Russian stuff from Mars. It was that time of day when you could see things very clear. See every little thing so far down the streets, fresh green just starting from the black branches of the trees and their holes in the concrete, and the flash of steel on a girl's boot a block away, like looking through a special kind of water that made seeing easier, even though it was nearly dark. He turned and stared up at the projects. Whole floors there were forever unlit, either derelict or the windows blacked out. What did they do in there? Maybe he'd ask Two-A-Day sometime. He checked the time on the kiosk's coke clock. His mother would be back from Boston by now. Had to be, or else she'd miss one of her favorite soaps. New hole in her head. She was crazy anyway. Nothing wrong with the socket she'd had since before he was born. But she'd been whining for years about static and resolution and sensory bleed-over, so she'd finally swung the credit to go to Boston for some cheap-ass replacement. Kind of place where you don't even get an appointment for an operation. Walk in and they just slap it in your head. He knew her, yeah. How she'd come through the door with a wrapped bottle under her arm, not even take her coat off, just go straight over and jack into the Hitachi. Soap her brains out good for 6 solid hours. Her eyes would unfocus. And sometimes, if it was a really good episode, she'd drool a little. About every 20 minutes, she'd manage to remember to take a ladylike nip out of the bottle. She'd always been that way. As long as he could remember. Gradually sliding deeper into her half-dozen synthetic lives. Sequential simstim fantasies Bobby had had to hear about all his life. He still harbored creepy feelings that some of the characters she talked about were relatives of his. Rich and beautiful aunts and uncles who might turn up one day, if only he weren't such a little shit. Maybe he thought now it had been true, in a way. She'd jacked that shit straight through the pregnancy. Because she'd told him she had, so he, fetus Newmark, curled up in there, had reverberated to about 1,000 hours of People of Importance and Atlanta. But he didn't like to think about being curled up in Marcia Newmark's belly. It made him feel sweaty and kind of sick. Marcia Mama. Only in the past year or so had Bobby come to understand the world well enough, as he now saw it, to wonder exactly how she still managed to make her way in it, marginal as that way had become, with her bottle and the socket ghosts to keep her company. Sometimes, when she was in a certain mood, and had had the right number of nips, she still tried to tell him stories about his father. He'd known since age 4 that these were bullshit, because the details changed from time to time. But for years, he'd allowed himself a certain pleasure in them anyway. He found a loading bay a few blocks west of Leon's, screened from the street by a freshly painted blue dumpster, the new paint gleaming over pocked, dented steel. There was a single halogen tube slung above the bay. He found a comfortable ledge of concrete and sat down there, careful not to jar the Ono Sendai. Sometimes you just had to wait. That was one of the things Two-A-Day had taught him. The dumpster was overflowing with a varied hash of industrial scrap. Barrytown had its share of gray legal manufacturers, part of the shadow economy, the news faces like to talk about. But Bobby never paid much attention to news faces. Biz. It was all just biz. Moth strobed crooked orbits around the halogen tube. Bobby watched blankly as three kids, maybe 10 at the oldest, scaled the blue wall of the dumpster with a length of dirty white nylon line and a makeshift grapple that might once have been part of a coat rack. When the last one made it over the top, into the mess of plastic scrap, the line was drawn swiftly up. The scrap began to creak and rustle.
Just like me, Bobby thought. I used to do that shit. Fill my room up with weird garbage I'd find.
One time, Ling Warren's sister found most of somebody's arm, all wrapped in green plastic and done up with rubber bands. Marsha Mama'd get these two-hour fits of religion sometimes. Come into Bobby's room and sweep all his best garbage out and gum some god-awful self-adhesive hologram up over his bed. Maybe Jesus, maybe Hubbard, maybe Virgin Mary. It didn't much matter to her when the mood was on her. It used to piss Bobby off real good, until one day he was big enough to walk into the front room with a ball-peen hammer and cock it over the Hitachi. You touch my stuff again and I'll kill your friends, Mom. All of them. She never tried it again. But the stick on holograms had actually had some effect on Bobby, because religion was now something he felt he'd considered and put aside. Basically, the way he figured it, there were just some people around who needed that shit. And he guessed there always had been, but he wasn't one of them. So, he didn't. Now one of the dumpster kids popped up and conducted a slit-eyed survey of the immediate area, then ducked out of sight again. There was a clunking, scraping sound. Small white hands tipped a dented alloy canister up and over the edge, lowering it on the nylon line. Good score, Bobby thought. You could take the thing to a metal dealer and get a little for it. They lowered the thing to the pavement, about a meter from the soles of Bobby's boots. As it touched down, it happened to twist around, showing him the six-horned symbol that stood for biohazard. "Hey, fuck!" he said, drawing his feet up reflexively. One of them slid down the rope and steadied the canister. The other two followed. He saw that they were younger than he'd thought. "Hey!" Bobby said. "You know that could be some real bad shit? Give you cancer and stuff."
"Go lick a dog's ass till it bleeds,"
the first kid down the rope advised him, as they flicked their grapple loose, coiled their line, and dragged the canister around the corner of the dumpster and out of sight. He gave it an hour and a half. Time enough. Leon's was starting to cook. At least 20 gothics postured in the main room like a herd of baby dinosaurs, their crests of lacquered hair bobbing and twitching. The majority approached the gothic ideal. Tall, lean, muscular, but touched by a certain gaunt restlessness. Young athletes in the early stages of consumption. The graveyard pallor was mandatory, and gothic hair was by definition black. Bobby knew that the few who couldn't warp their bodies to fit the subcultural template were best avoided. A short gothic was trouble. A fat gothic, homicidal. Now he watched them flexing and glittering in Leon's like a composite creature, slime mold with a jigsaw surface of dark leather and stainless spikes. Most of them had nearly identical faces, features reworked to match ancient archetypes culled from kino banks. He chose a particularly artful Dean, whose hair swayed like the mating display of a nocturnal lizard.
"Bro,"
Bobby began, uncertain if he'd met this one before.
"My man,"
the Dean responded languidly, his left cheek distended by a cut of resin.
"The Count, baby,"
as an aside to his girl.
"Count Zero Interrupt."
Long pale hand with a fresh scab across the back, grabbing ass through the girl's leather skirt.
"Count, this is my squeeze."
The gothic girl regarded Bobby with mild interest, but no flash of human recognition whatever, as though she was seeing an ad for a product she'd heard of but had no intention of buying. Bobby scanned the crowd. A few blank faces, but none he knew. No two-a-day.
"Say, hey,"
he confided.
"How you know how it is and all? I'm looking for this close, personal friend, business friend."
And at this, the gothic sagely bobbed his crest.
"Goes by two a day."
He paused. The gothic looked blank, snapping his resin. The girl looked bored, restless.
"Where, man?"
Bobby added, raising his eyebrows.
"Black where, man. Today,"
the gothic said.
"Sure. Today. Right, babe?"
His girl tossed her head and looked away.
"You know him?" "Sure."
"He here tonight?"
"No,"
the gothic said and smiled meaninglessly. Bobby opened his mouth, closed it, forced himself to nod.
"Thanks, bro. Anything for my man,"
the gothic said. Another hour, more of the same. Too much white, chalk-pale gothic white. Flat, bright eyes of their girls, their boot heels like ebony needles. He tried to stay out of the Simstim room, where Leon was running some kind of weird jungle fuck tape, phased you in and out of these different kind of animals. A lot of crazed arboreal action up in the trees, which Bobby found a little disorienting. He was hungry enough now to feel a little spaced. Or maybe it was afterburn from whatever it was had happened to him before. But he was starting to have a hard time concentrating, and his thoughts drifted in odd directions. Like who, for instance, had climbed up into those trees full of snakes and wired a pair of those rat things for Simstim. The gothics were into it, whoever. They were thrashing and stomping and generally into major tree rat identification. Leon's new hit tape, Bobby decided. Just to his left, but well out of range of the stim, two project girls stood, their Baroque finery in sharp contrast with gothic monochrome. Long black frock coats opened over tight red vests and silk brocade, the tails of enormous white shirts hanging well beneath their knees. Their dark features were concealed beneath the brims of fedoras, pinned and hung with fragments of antique gold, stick pins, charms, teeth, mechanical watches. Bobby watched them covertly. The clothes said they had money, but that someone would make it worth your ass if you tried to go for it. One time, Two-A-Day had come down from the projects in this ice-blue, shaved velour number with diamond buckles at the knees, like maybe he hadn't had time to change. But Bobby had acted like the wear-man was dressed in his usual leathers because he figured a cosmopolitan attitude was crucial in biz. He tried to imagine going up to them so smooth, just putting it to them.
"Hey, you ladies surely must know my good friend, Mr. Two-A-Day."
But they were older than he was, taller, and moved with a dignity he found intimidating. Probably they'd just laugh, but somehow, he didn't want that at all. What he did want now, and very badly, was food. He touched his credit chip through the denim of his jeans. He'd go across the street and get a sandwich. Then he remembered why he was here, and suddenly it didn't seem very smart to use his chip. If he'd been sussed, after his attempted run, they'd have his chip number by now. Using it would spotlight him for anyone tracking him in cyberspace. Pick him out in the Barrytown grid like a highway flare in a dark football stadium. He had his cash money, but you couldn't pay for food with that. It wasn't actually illegal to have the stuff. It was just that nobody ever did anything legitimate with it. He'd have to find a gothic with a chip, buy a new yen's worth of credit, probably at a vicious discount, then have the gothic pay for the food. And what the hell was he supposed to take his change in? Maybe you're just spooked, he told himself. He didn't know for sure that he was being backtracked. And the base he'd tried to crack was legit, or was supposed to be legit. That was why Tuaday had told him he didn't have to worry about black ice. Who'd put lethal feedback programs around a place that leased soft kino porn? The idea had been that he'd bleep out a few hours of digitalized kino. New stuff that hadn't made it to the bootleg market. It wasn't the kind of score anybody was liable to kill you for. But somebody had tried. And something else had happened. Something entirely else. He trudged back up the stairs again, out of Leon's. He knew there was a lot he didn't know about the Matrix, but he'd never heard of anything that weird. You got ghost stories, sure, and hot doggers who swore they'd seen things in cyberspace, but he had them figured for Wilsons who jacked in dusted. You could hallucinate in the Matrix as easily as anywhere else. Maybe that's what happened, he thought. The voice was just part of dying, being flatlined, some crazy bullshit your brain threw up to make you feel better, and something had happened back at the source. Maybe a brownout in their part of the grid, so the ice had lost its hold on his nervous system. Maybe. But he didn't know. Didn't know the turf. His ignorance had started to dig into him recently because it kept him from making the moves he needed to make. He hadn't ever much thought about it before, but he didn't really know that much about anything in particular. In fact, up until he'd started hot-dogging, he'd felt like he knew about as much as he needed to. And that was what the gothics were like. And that was why the gothics would stay here and burn themselves down on dust, or get chopped out by casuals. And the process of attrition would produce the percentage of them who'd somehow become the next wave of child-bearing, condo-buying Barrytowners. And the whole thing could go round again. He was like a kid who'd grown up beside an ocean, taking it as much for granted as he took the sky, but knowing nothing of currents, shipping routes, or the ins and outs of weather. He'd used decks in school, toys that shuttled you through the infinite reaches of that space that wasn't space. Mankind's unthinkably complex, consensual hallucination. The Matrix. Cyberspace. Where the great corporate hot cores burned like neon novas. Data so dense you suffered sensory overload if you tried to apprehend more than the merest outline. But since he'd started hot-dogging, he had some idea of how precious little he knew about how anything worked, and not just in the Matrix. It spilled over somehow, and he'd started to wonder and think. how Barrytown worked, what kept his mother going, why gothics and casuals invested all that energy in trying to kill each other off, or why Two-A-Day was black and lived up in the projects, and what made that different. As he walked, he kept up his search for the dealer. White faces, more white faces. His stomach had started to make a certain amount of noise. He thought about the fresh package of wheat cutlets in the fridge at home. Fry them up with some soy and crack a pack of krill wafers. Passing the kiosk again, he checked the Coke clock. Marcia was home for sure, deep in the labyrinthine complexities of people of importance, whose female protagonist's life she'd shared through a socket for almost 20 years. The Asahi Shimbun fax was still rolling down behind its little window, and he stepped closer, in time to see the first report of the bombing of A Block Level 3 Covina Concourse Courts, Barrytown, New Jersey. Then it was gone, passed, and there was a story about the formal funeral of the Cleveland Yakuza boss, strictly trad. They all carried black umbrellas. He'd lived all his life in 503 A Block. That enormous thing, leaning in, to stomp Marcia Newmark and her Hitachi flat. And of course, it had been meant for him. "There's somebody doesn't mess around," he heard himself say. "Hey, my man, Count, you dusted, bro? Hey, where you heading?" The eyes of two deans twisting to follow him in the course of his headlong panic. Chapter 7. The Mall. Conroy swung the blue Fokker off the eroded ribbon of pre-war highway and throttled down. The long rooster tail of pale dust that had followed them from Needles began to settle. The hovercraft sank into its inflated apron bag as they came to a halt. "Here's the venue, Turner."
"What hit it?"
Rectangular expanse of concrete spreading to uneven walls of weathered cinder block. "Economics," Conroy said. "Before the war. They never finished it. 10 clicks west of here and there's whole subdivisions, just pavement grids, no houses, nothing."
"How big a site, team?"
9, not counting you. And the medics."
"What medics?"
"Osakas. Masa's biologicals, right? No telling how they might have our boy kinked. So Hosaka's built a regular little neurosurgery and staffed it with 3 hotshots. 2 of them are company men. The 3rd's a Korean who knows black medicine from both ends. Medical pods in that long one there," he pointed. "Got a partial section of roof."
"How'd you get it on site?"
"Brought it from Tucson inside a tanker. Faked a breakdown, got it out, rolled it in. Took all hands. Maybe 3 minutes.
"Mas," Turner said.
"Sure." Conroy killed the engines. "Chance you take," he said in the abrupt silence. "Maybe they missed it. Our guy in the tanker sat there and bitched to his dispatcher in Tucson on the CB, all about his shit-eating heat exchanger and how long it was going to take to fix it. Figure they picked that up. You think of a better way to do it?"
"No.
Given that the client wants the thing on the site. But we're sitting here now in the middle of their recon footprint." "Sweetheart." And Conroy snorted. "Maybe we just stopped for a screw. Break up our trip to Tucson, right? It's that kind of place. People stop here to piss, you know." He checked his black Porsche watch. "I'm due there in an hour. Get a copter back to the coast."
"The rig?"
"No. Your fucking jet. Figured I handle that myself."
"Good."
"I'd go for a Dornier system ground effect plane myself. Have it wait down the road until we see Mitchell heading in. It could get here by the time the medics clean him up. We toss him in and take off for the Sonora border.
At subsonic speeds? Turner said. No way. You're on your way to California to buy me that jump jet. Our boy is going out of here in a multi-mission combat aircraft that's barely even obsolete.
You got a pilot in mind?
Me.
Turner said, and tapped the socket behind his ear.
It's a fully integrated interactive system.
They'll sell you the interface software, and I'll jack straight in. Didn't know you could fly.
I can't.
You don't need hands-on to haul ass for Mexico City.
Still the wild boy, Turner.
You know the rumors that somebody blew your dick off back there in New Delhi? Conroy swung around to face him, his grin cold and clean.
Turner dug the park out from behind the seat and took out the pistol and the box of ammunition. He was stuffing the parka back again when Conroy said,
"Keep it. It gets cold as hell here at night."
Turner reached for the canopy latch, and Conroy revved the engines.
The hovercraft rose a few centimeters, swaying slightly as Turner popped the canopy and climbed out. Whiteout sun and air like hot velvet.
He took his Mexican sunglasses from the pocket of the blue work shirt and put them on. He wore white deck shoes and a pair of tropical combat fatigues. The box of explosive shells went into one of the thigh pockets on the fatigues. He kept the gun in his right hand, the parka bundled under his left arm.
"Head for the long building," Conroy said over the engine. "They're expecting you."
He jumped down into the furnace glow of desert noon as Conroy revved the Fokker again and edged it back to the highway. He watched as it sped east, its receding image distorted through wrinkles of rising heat. When it was gone, there was no sound at all, no movement. He turned, facing the ruin. Something small and stone-gray darted between two rocks. Perhaps 80 meters from the highway, the jagged walls began. The expanse between had once been a parking lot. 5 steps forward and he stopped. He heard the sea, surf pounding, soft explosions as breakers fell. The gun was in his hand, too large, too real, its metal warming in the sun. "No sea, no sea," he told himself. "Can't hear it." He walked on, the deck shoes slipping in drifts of ancient window glass seasoned with brown and green shards of bottle. There were rusted discs that had been bottle caps, flattened rectangles that had been aluminum cans. Insects whirred up from low clumps of dry brush.
Over. Done with. This place. No time.
He stopped again, straining forward, as though he sought something that would help him name the thing that was rising in him. Something hollow. The mall was doubly dead. The beach hotel in Mexico had lived once, at least for a season. Beyond the parking lot, the sunlit cinder block, cheap and soulless, waiting. He found them crouched in the narrow strip of shade provided by a length of gray wall. 3 of them. He smelled the coffee before he saw them. The fire-blackened enamel pot balanced precariously on the tiny Primus cooker. He was meant to smell it, of course. They were expecting him. Otherwise, he'd have found the ruin empty, and then somehow, very quietly, and almost naturally, he would have died. 2 men, a woman. Cracked, dusty boots out of Texas. Denim so shiny with grease that it would probably be waterproof. The men were bearded, their uncut hair bound up in sun-bleached topknots with lengths of rawhide. The woman's hair center-parted and pulled back tight from a seamed, wind-burnt face.
An ancient BMW motorcycle was propped against the wall. Flecked chrome and battered paintwork daubed with airbrush blobs of tan and gray desert camo. He released the Smith & Wesson's grip